Well, I've started the recording here for this session because it is now 11 o'clock Mountain Time, so I want to give Anna-Marieke the time she requires for this wonderful presentation. And before she gets started, I'd like to welcome everyone to the CIDR Sessions. As always, the CIDR Sessions are recorded, and this will be available from the CIDR site. In addition to the Illuminate recording, an MP3 recording and a PowerPoint slideshow will be posted below the description of the presentation on the CIDR website. And I'm going to post the link for you in the text box so that you can access that. There we go. It's up. And I'd like to also mention that during the presentation, Anna-Marieke will be stopping periodically to invite discussion and questions. And at that time, please don't be shy. Feel free to use your microphone and make your comments using the audio capabilities here in Illuminate. If you don't have a mic today or those, you can always use the text box, and you can use the text box at any time during the presentation, okay? And I'll try to draw Anna-Marieke's attention to any questions that come up there. Now, I'd like to introduce Dr. Anna-Marieke Hoekstra from the Northern Alberta Institute of Technology. Anna-Marieke is originally from the Netherlands. Her university education began at the University of Utrecht, where she studied Dutch linguistics and literature. She specialized both in applied linguistics and in intercultural communication. As part of her master's degree program, Anna-Marieke completed a research traineeship at the Research Center for the Faculty of Teacher Education at Hogeschool Utrecht. And her research focused on student teachers' perceptions of the multicultural classroom. Her master's thesis on knowledge construction in math lessons in multicultural classrooms was actually granted the Anella 2002 award for best master's thesis in the field of applied linguistics in the Netherlands. From 2003 to 2007, Anna-Marieke worked as a PhD student at IVLOS, Institute of Education, at the University of Utrecht. Her research focused on experienced secondary school teachers learning in the workplace, and she has presented this research at several national and international conferences already, such as ORD, ISAT, and AERA. Anna-Marieke moved to Canada recently, actually, in June 2007, and taught statistics at the J.R. Shaw School of Business for a year. She's now a research consultant at the Center for Teaching and Learning at NAIT and is working on advancing the scholarship of teaching and learning at NAIT. And we're very happy to have you here, Anna-Marieke, to discuss your research on teacher learning, informal learning. So I'll stop now and turn the mic over to you and let you proceed.
Thank you very much, Lynn. I was going to say good morning, Eastern Canada, and good afternoon, Western Canada and Florida, and good evening, the Netherlands, because there's also some people from the Netherlands online. So I'm very excited to have the opportunity to talk to several different audiences at once, and I was wondering if there is anybody that is outside Canada. Canada, Florida, and the Netherlands online right now. So if that person could identify him or herself, because then I will say good morning or good afternoon or good evening, depending on where you are. Maybe identify yourself in the Juneau, Alaska. Welcome, Heidi. Anyone else? I guess for you it would also be morning, so good morning. I'm going to start my presentation. Okay, Peggy cannot hear me. I don't know what that's all about. I'm going to start my presentation with an introduction of a larger research project in the Netherlands that my PhD project was part of. And then I will introduce two related studies of experienced secondary school teachers in formal workplace learning that also was also conducted in the Netherlands. These two studies were both based on the same conceptual framework that I will start with when I explain the larger research project. And I would like to finish the presentation with the discussion on the implications for research in distance education. I will not be looking too much to the chat box. Hopefully Lena's going to help me with that. She promised me. So whenever you want to ask a question, that I will have sometimes, I will just ask you if you have any questions. Other than that, please ask your questions in the chat box. Okay, so before I start explaining the larger research project, I would like to express my gratitude to all the people that I've been working with over the past 4 years in the Netherlands. I was part of a research project that was conducted by people from five different universities in the Netherlands in the year 2003 to 2007. And this project was funded by the Netherlands Organization of Scientific Research, which is the Dutch equivalent of the Tri-Council Canada. The project leader was Dr. Theo Wubbels of Utrecht University, and there were four full-time researchers involved, including myself. Dr. Inge Bakkenes was the postdoctoral fellow. Jacobine Meiring, Rosanne Zwart, and I were PhD students. And then we all had our own supervisors and advisors, and they were also part of this larger research project. The aim of the project, all these 16 people together, was to combine insights from cognitive approaches to learning with insights from theories of learning in organizations. The second purpose was to develop a conceptual framework of teacher learning in the workplace. And the third was very important for all of us, is to learn from each other in collaboration. As these people were all working in different universities, they all have their different perspectives and approaches to learning. So to have all these very experienced people together in one room was a challenge and a very helpful for all of our learning processes. So in this larger research project, we needed a definition of learning that allows for input from both the cognitive psychology perspective as well as a learning in organizations perspective. So based on the notion of learning as an active process that results in a change of behavior or capacity for behavior, we defined our, which is based on work by conducted by Shuel. On the website, by the way, you will be able to find the whole reference list of my dissertation. So any of these references that I mentioned during the presentation, you will be able to find them online. So based on this notion of learning from Shuel, we have defined in the larger research project, teacher learning is engaging in activities that lead to a change in cognition and or teaching behavior. So that is the definition, which is really central to the whole research project. As you will see when I explain the conceptual framework. Now, part of this larger project was my PhD project that was aimed at this exploring informal workplace learning. The other two PhD students had a different context in which they studied teachers' learning. Jacobine, she studied teacher learning in the context of collaborative groups of teachers, whereas Rosanna studied teacher learning in the context of reciprocal peer coaching. Both their projects involved an intervention that is an explicit program set up to help teachers learn. Now, in my project, we wanted to study a context in which there was no such project set up, and we called it informal workplace learning. Then diving in the literature, it turned out that there was and still is much debate on whether or not you should use the word informal in the definition. Marsick and Watkins, in their book in 1990, refer to informal learning as incidental and unintentional. So they say informal learning is something else than formal learning, and that something else is that it is different in nature from formal learning, and it is incidental and unintentional, so unplanned. However, other researchers say, well, you know what? They distinguish learning in a formal or informal context, but the context does not always define learning itself. So there is much debate over whether or not you should use the term informal. Stephen Billett argues against its use and says that to describe anything by what it's not is imprecise. We've had extensive discussion about this at the last AERA in New York. And he also says incidental and unintentional learning also happens in formal education, which is, of course, true. Now, for our purpose of our own research, we have defined informal learning by its context to distinguish from the other two PhD projects. So in our study, informal learning is defined as learning that is not systematically supported by any program explicitly organized to foster teacher learning. So that is the definition that we go by. So the situation where teachers are not explicitly supported in an ongoing program. So that doesn't mean that they cannot go to any workshops, but they're not systematically supported in a collaborative program that is ongoing for a year or something like that. Okay, I wasn't going to show this slide yet. I wanted to ask the audience to think about a learning experience that in your workplace. And in particular, I would like you to think about how did you learn in your workplace to chair a meeting. So in the answers that any kind of informal workplace learning activities that you have engaged in to learn how to chair a meeting, please feel free to enter them in the chat box. So first going to Google to explore resources, learning from others. Anyone else? How did you learn how to chair a meeting? Example from others, learn by looking others doing it, so observation. Robert's Rules of Order, you may have learned that in school. Observations, watch how someone experienced does it. So in our school, we did not learn the Robert's Rule of Order, but I would suggest that there is two different kinds of learning. One is where somebody tells you how it's done, and another one is just observing somebody do it, and then probably also practicing it yourself as you are chairing a meeting. So some of these activities can be, like if you learn it in fourth grade, I would consider that a formal learning environment. If you learn it through observations, I would consider it more informal ways of learning. Now, you may also have noticed that it's not always easy to explain how you learn something. So in a number of different studies, teachers have been asked, how did you learn certain things in your work? And that's kind of research on workplace learning activities is what I call self-reported activities. That is where teachers say, well, you know, I learned this through collaboration with my peers. I learned it by doing it in a classroom, by scanning resources. As Terry said, he always goes to Google first. There's another strand of research that looked at learning experiences, learning activities more from the mental perspective. And for instance, for Munda and for Lobo were in our larger research project. They have studied students' learning activities and looked specifically at the mental learning activities. So given these two strands of literature, we have we wanted to combine insights from both studies. So what we did is we developed a conceptual framework in which workplace learning activities are considered to have an action level as well as a mental level simultaneously. And following our definition of learning as and engaging in activities that lead to a change in cognition and or behavior, we distinguish between learning activities, and this is beautiful, and changing cognition and behavior on the other side. This is particularly important in our second research project. So before we started the project, we looked at how would we study this learning. And I'm almost going to give you time for questions. So how do you study informal learning if it's so hard for people to explain how they learn certain things? So we dived in the literature of teacher learning, and we saw that people have used retrospective interviews on beliefs and how they change over time, a storyline method on the development of important aspects of teaching. A storyline method is where people plot a line in a graph and then explain to the researcher when the line is going up what that means and what happened at that point in time. And when the line goes down, the same thing, what situation did make the line go down, what was happening. That's the storyline method. And then also others have used written questionnaires on the development of expertise. The results of these studies show that teachers change and learn most in the beginning of their teaching career. The learning occurs through key experiences, and that learning takes place gradually. However, regarding the methods, they all use teacher self-report. They use, if you ask teachers to look back 20 years, it's teachers only remember their key experiences, not the day-to-day practices. The memory of teachers may be selective and colored, so that may have an impact on the validity of your results. And learning might take place implicitly, so people won't be able to report on it. So what we try to do is address these problems by studying a teacher's learning as it takes place. At this point in time, I would like to give everyone a chance to ask some questions about our conceptual framework, and after that I will go talk about the first study.
Ashley and Marika, I have a question. You were talking a lot about drawing from teachers about how they've learned. Did you also find they had difficulties even saying what they had learned? Because I know sometimes we take for granted what we know.
I have not done that myself, but I've seen in the literature that, especially in literature on student learning in the vocations, like in their traineeships, that they find it hard to actually talk about what they learn. However, when a researcher follows them on the job and follows and say, well, I saw that you did this, how did you learn that? So in that case, when a researcher helps make the learner make explicit what was learned, then it was easier for the participants to talk about it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense if somebody's pointing it out that you're demonstrating a behavior that isn't perhaps natural to others.
Any other questions?
I just have a comment. Marcel Dartmouth, Nova Scotia Community College here in Nova Scotia. We're actually required now to document our learning through a portfolio process. So not only do we go and learn things, but we actually have to document it and write reflective papers on them and log books or journals or whatever manner you want to capture that. But it's actually becoming a required piece not only for our students but for faculty as well.
I can imagine that that creates some challenges as to, well, you know, making explicit what you learned and how you learned it. Although I do believe that reporting it in that way helps you also to show to others how you have developed.
Absolutely, and it holds more weight and carries validity because we can prove or we can showcase what we have learned.
Marcel, now are you speaking about recording more informal learning, more formal learning experiences in your e-portfolio, or are you talking to both formal and informal experiences in learning?
Yes, the latter, both. Sorry, you may not have heard. I said yes, both informal and formal learning.
Great, thank you. Yes, I did hear. I just wanted to clarify. And I like what Terry wrote there, too. I don't know if you saw that, Anne-Marie, that this also illustrates the problem with self-reporting. Without the teacher to without the researcher, to twig, things get ignored. And I have to agree with that. Like, we're not aware of what we know a lot of the times as teachers, I think, in particular.
Yes, that's what makes the portfolio process so great, is that we get to think about and reflect on the things that we know and then log them, so it helps us know what we know.
Exactly. I just want to make sure that there is no other questions, so I'm going to talk about how we address this problem in our study. So any other urgent questions at this point? Okay, well, obviously this problem of self-report created some challenges for us. However, if you look at the conceptual framework of informal learning, is that learning might take place implicitly, and we wanted to study teachers' learning in a context that was where there was no intervention, and I would consider an e-portfolio almost as a form of intervention because it makes learning more explicit and more conscious. So what we wanted to do is to capture some of the learning that might take place implicitly, and therefore we did not intend to make the teachers during the research more aware of what we were looking for. So I'll tell you what we did, and then you can decide for yourself if you think that was a good plan or not. It was definitely challenging, but also a lot of fun to do. Okay, so what we did is we did an exploratory case study, and the aim of this first study was to provide empirical underpinnings for a theoretical categorization of teachers' learning activities during teaching on three levels distinguished by Eraut, which is you can find that in the reference list. So what Eraut did is he created a model of informal learning by saying, you know, there's in an informal learning environment, there is deliberative learning, reactive learning, and implicit learning going on at the same time. Deliberative learning may be intentional, as in, for instance, going to Google and find out how to chair a meeting, or going to Google and find out what a certain thing means. So deliberative learning is intentional, conscious. You have to be conscious of it if you have an intention, I would say, almost. Reactive learning is unintentional, it just happened, and it becomes conscious afterwards. Something happened and you learn from it and you realize something. That's reactive learning. And implicit learning is unintentional, beyond the learner's awareness. So what we wanted to do is we wanted to find out what kind of activities teachers engage in during teaching, as they are teaching, so to capture that gradual learning process, and whether we could distinguish activities on the level of deliberative learning, reactive learning, and as well as implicit learning. So to find implicit learning, we decided we need to look at these teachers for a longer period of time. Otherwise, we cannot see if there's any changes going on with this teacher. So the underlying assumptions of our studies were learning takes place through engagement in activities. These activities have an action level as well as a mental level. And in our in this first study, we distinguished even between the mental level of activities between emotion, motivation, and cognition. And then the third assumption is that teachers can be more or less consciously aware of the activities they engaged in. So we followed four experienced teachers by videotaping their lessons. And each teacher, we observed six lessons during 1 year while teaching the same group of students. So to be able to compare how teachers are doing during the year. And we limited ourselves and also allowed ourselves to compare activities by focusing on teachers' activities that foster students' active and self-regulated learning. This was the philosophy of fostering active and self-regulated learning was part of a major reform implemented in 1998. And even though teachers were not forced to do this, there were lots of incentives had been going on to promote teachers to foster active and self-regulated learning. So at the time of study, the initial reform already had taken place a few years ago, but there were still teachers struggling with how to do this in the classroom. So to compare between teachers, we looked at this particular issue within their jobs. And then with each teacher, we focus on a major individual concern of the teacher, an issue that the teacher wants to improve. Because if the teacher didn't want to improve that issue, then we would expect the teacher to do the same throughout the year and not be able to observe their learning. So even though we asked the teachers for their major concern, we didn't tell them that that was the focus of, that we were going to focus on that concern during that year. So we started with a concern interview to elicit some of the teachers' major concerns. Then we video recorded six lessons. I failed to mention that these were experienced secondary school teachers, all teaching in high school. After each lesson, we selected four concern-related situations per lesson. So if a teacher had a concern that she wanted to teach less in a frontal way, so less often stand in front of the class and talk and more often facilitate students, then we would look both at where she did teach frontally and situations where she didn't and look at how that evolved over the year. And then we interviewed the teacher after the lesson about those four fragments. And in this we asked, we didn't ask why did you do this because we didn't want rationalizations, because that would involve becoming aware or becoming more aware, and we didn't want to interfere as much. So we only asked, what was going on inside you? How did you feel in the situation? What did you want? And what were your thoughts? So we didn't want to have the teacher become to rationalize afterwards. So an example of... Yeah, I'm just going to show an example of one of those situations first. This is how we, so in the end we had 24 situations from each teacher, four situations per lesson, six lessons per teacher. So we had 24 for each of the four teachers, that is almost 100 situations. So from each situation we made an illustration. And in the right corner here, you see a description of the situation, then the interview data regarding the situation, and our initial comments regarding the situation. So this situation, piece of data is about Nicole, and Nicole was the teacher that expressed that she wanted to teach less frontally and wanted to facilitate students' learning. So the situation goes as follows. Four students sit together in a group. The girl at the left asks a question. Nicole, the teacher, starts reading the assignments for herself silently, and the girl, the because she wanted to help them out with that assignment. While she was reading the assignment silently, the girl at the right starts answering the question, and the girl starts having a discussion. And this is exactly what Nicole wanted in that situation, is she did want to have the students have discussions amongst each other, and she didn't want to intervene as much. So afterwards she said about the situation, Nicole explained, when they ask a question, I have to quickly read those pieces of text and anticipate their question, which is rather difficult. Those two are working on the same question, so when I notice that the other girl already had a standpoint towards the question, then I try to get that out of her, because then I do not have to think myself, and in the meantime I can make up my mind, and then I can calmly read the question. When I walked away from these girls, I felt content that these students started discussing without my intervention. So Nicole had the intent to read the question for herself to properly address the student's question. However, while she was silently reading this, the girls started talking amongst each other. And then, in the end, she felt content that she hadn't interfered, that the student started discussing without my intervention. So our comments were that this situation is related to Nicole's concern, because even though she did not intend the students to discuss together and do the thinking, this is what happened, as Nicole felt the need to read the assignment first for her own orientation. The fact that the students started their discussion on their own accord gives her a pleasant feeling. So we categorized this activity later on as a reactive learning activity. It wasn't intentional. She did not intend to practice not interfering. It only happened because she needed to read the question first. But afterwards, she was happy that it happened and that the students had started discussing without her intervention. So this is a way where we try to capture a little bit of the gradual learning that is going on during teaching. So to go back to the former slide, and I will give you lots of time to ask questions in a few minutes. First, we interpreted the data per situation. Then we formulated tentative codes for the activities that we saw in each situation. We categorized the activities into deliberative, reactive, and implicit. And the example that I just showed you would be an example of a reactive activity. And then we did the within and cross-case comparisons of the activities to come up with a categorization of activities into these three levels of learning. So to quickly go through our findings, in deliberative learning we found that teachers during their teaching were engaged in planning. Okay, so today we're going to do this and this and this and this in their own head. So those were mental activities. They were also involved in practicing. Sometimes they practiced what they were already good at, so as to reinforce what works. They were also engaged in experimenting with new assignments, new behavior, new ways of explaining certain concepts. And I made a different category for trying out new behavior, because I found that, especially for experienced teachers that want to show new behavior as opposed to their routine behavior, they always felt a tendency and a certain feeling, a tendency to behave in their old way, a tendency, for instance, to immediately give the students an answer without giving them time to discuss it amongst themselves. So during trying out new behavior, I found that the teachers were doing what I call self-control. They were suppressing the emotions, and they were suppressing tendencies to act in their old ways. And I can go on into this, but then I won't have time to discuss the second study. So if you want to know more about that, read the article that I wrote about it, or we can discuss this afterwards. The last activity that I found teachers occasionally do, actually only one of the four teachers ever did it, when I was observing her seeking explicit student feedback, and that actually greatly helped her to to reflect on her own practice. So this is the deliberative learning. Then I found becoming aware of certain things, so, like Nicole became aware that that the students started discussing amongst each other and that she did not always have to give the answer straight away. Sometimes teachers became aware, for instance, that they were running out of time and changed the course of action. So even though they wanted to have students collaborate very much, they decided, you know, we are running out of time, so I'm going to change my plan. I'm going to do something else right now. Or becoming aware and reframing. Reframing is a term that is, well, that I derived from Schön. That means a reinterpretation of the situation. And one of the teachers, she observed that some of her students that she perceived as very smart students were not working on the assignment that she gave them. And she assumed, as she told me later, that these students were lazy and weren't motivated. And when she started addressing them in a reproachful manner, the students objected and said, well, we find this assignment really difficult. So for the teacher, she became aware of her own preconceptions and then reframed the situation according to what the students told her. So no, they weren't lazy, they just had difficulties with the assignment. So that happened all during classroom teaching. These reactive activities are usually followed by deliberative learning activities. And then implicit learning, which was the most difficult to find, was that sometimes we saw that through being in certain situations repeatedly, and in that situation the teacher felt, for instance, frustrated with two students that never seemed to want to work, that these situations strengthened certain beliefs of the teachers and became more polarized in a sense. And another thing that we observed is that without the teacher's awareness, sometimes teachers were inhibited by feelings that they that in the situation they were not aware of. So a tendency to interfere, for instance, is work against their wish to give the students more chance to collaborate amongst themselves. So I see a number of questions have come up. So let's see. I'll just give the mic to the audience right now.
Anna Marie, Jason had a good question there. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at that one. It's Jason CDA, second last.
I'm reading it right now. With self-control, did they reduce this impact after the multiple recorded sections or later in the lesson once they stopped thinking about others seeing them perform in the classroom? Jason, could you please elaborate on your question?
Hi, all. What I was just looking at was when you were talking about deliberative learning and the impact, if I understood, and it was more of a question of clarification on self-control, you were talking about that trying out that new behavior, but also understanding that they're practicing it, having somebody else see them. I wondered if after the multiple sessions that you did or in a longer duration class, if they forgot about the camera and they actually just performed, if that was impacted in your study.
That is a very good question. There were two things that made me feel more confident about Two things make me feel that the camera wasn't so much of an intervention. One is that the teachers told me explicitly that they just forgot about the camera altogether. I always had done one or two practice lessons with them. So before I actually started the research, the actual data collection, so that they as well as the students would feel more comfortable with the camera. And the teachers told me that their lessons weren't any different. another thing that they told me is because I was always focusing on their own concern, but I had not told the teachers that I was following that particular issue within their teaching. And after the year, I asked the teacher, well, did you observe like some sort of commonality in the situations that I selected to interview them about? And they told me that they had no clue, that they had no idea why I would ask certain situations and not other situations, which is an indication for me that they did not become more aware of the concern and the concern related situations and activities. Also, we did not discuss in the interview, we did not discuss what I observed. I would not say anything. I would only ask, what did you feel, what did you want, and what did you think? And only later it was that I observed this commonality in trying out new behaviors, where the teacher said, I felt this, but I wanted to ignore it because I felt I wanted to change my behavior. Oh, of course, not exactly in those explicit terms, but that's what it came down to. Does this answer your question? I think it does, because you say excellent. Yeah, it was definitely one of the major aims to diminish the impact of my own presence. Marcel, can you elaborate on your addition, please?
Just in reference to making the assumptions that some students are lazy or don't work hard, same thing here. Sometimes you make those assumptions, but you find out later on that there are other external factors affecting the learning, and none of them are because they're lazy or don't want to do the work.
Hi, Enrique. I'm making parallels to the observations you had in a face-to-face classroom within an online environment, where the disorientation of faculty that they can't do the things that they practiced in the classroom over the years often makes them reflect and deliberate, and lots of reactive kind of situations happen that help them to learn. But my question is, when you were talking about observing informal learning, at least with your one example, and I know you did a lot more, but they were sort of learning which actually was taking place during the learning, their teaching sequences. And yet I think a lot of informal learning happens through either internal or external resources, where you're talking to other teachers in the classroom, or you see something on TV, or you read an article, or something like that. So did you look just at the sort of individual learning that happens in practice, or did you talk about or study how important it was or isn't important, the things that they learn outside of the actual teaching experience?
Thank you very much, Terry. That is a very good remark. I see that there is only 15 minutes left, and I just want my next study that I'm going to explain actually addresses exactly this. So let me just go to this second study so that both addressing your question as well as speeding up the process. In the second study, we used the same conceptual framework. The aim was to explore how teachers' informal learning activities can be related to teachers' change in beliefs and behavior. This was also a longitudinal study with 32 experienced teachers, including the four that took part in the first study. And I know that I do not have time to go over everything, but I will show you the activities that we looked at. So I'm sorry that I have to skip this. What we did is we started with teachers' questionnaires on active and self-regulated learning and student questionnaires on the behavior of the teachers. And what we wanted to know is, how did the teachers change from one year to the other? And in the meantime, we ask the teachers to report on their learning experiences. And in the learning experiences, we distinguished a number of different learning activities that they would report. So the framework for the study of learning activities was much wider than only learning in the classroom. So teachers were experimented in the classroom. They were reported to consider their own teaching approach afterwards. So that is the reflection that goes on after teaching. They sometimes experienced frictions between what they expected to happen and what actually happened. They reported to have struggled with behavioral tendencies, and they reported to get ideas from others. And getting ideas from others is in collaboration, in serving the net, in scanning resources. And what we did, if you remember our first conceptual framework, where we said that each learning activity has an observable as well as a mental component. So these were all of the these were all of the observable components, and then at the same time we also coded the teacher's mental activities. So we made a distinction whether the teacher was aimed at improving action. For instance, I got this idea and I'm going to try it out, or I experimented with this and I'm going to do it again. So I'm going to try it out and I'm going to do it again are conclusions that they made that are action-oriented. The other type of mental activity that we distinguished is meaning-oriented, where the teacher did say, for instance, learning from this experiment, I now understand that students learn in a certain way, or that certain students do not learn like other students. So that was aimed at understanding the situation more so than aimed at formulating what they were going to do in the future. So what we did is we coded the activities that the teachers reported during the year, and then we counted how many times the teacher reported a certain activity during the year, and we by means of a quantitative analysis, we related the activities to the changes in behavior. And you will be able to later see in the PowerPoint all the exact analysis and ANOVAs that we did. I'm just going to the slide with the results. And yeah, we're running out of time, and I would certainly want some discussion. So our results show basically that the teachers that became more oriented towards the reform during the year, they were observed to experiment more often than all the others, and also to have gotten more ideas than others. And what was most important, that their activities involved very much meaning-oriented reflection. So that was one of our major findings. And I'm going to just go to almost my last slide here, which is not the one I want. Regarding the relationship between activities and changes in behavior, we couldn't find a similar straightforward results, but there was some indication that experimenting involving meaning-oriented reflection can be related to a change towards more reform-oriented behavior. So we certainly looked at other activities as well, but not in the first study, because in the first study was really aimed at exploring the gradual ways of learning by doing. So the overall conclusion is that teachers differ in the way they learn informally in the workplace, and that those teachers who became more ASL-oriented in their beliefs reported most often learning of activities with a focus on new practices, such as experimenting and getting new ideas, and also more often meaning-oriented mental activities. So there is a discussion question here, but there you can certainly ask other questions or give other comments for a discussion. So feel free to ask or give your contribution.
Well, it's Terry. I guess I would just comment that we really don't know very well how individual teachers learn to teach at a distance. I mean, many of us are involved in professional development activities, and we have these sort of initial, here's how you use the tools, and here are some good, some interesting practices. But beyond that, I think it's even worse, well, or as bad as in a face-to-face classroom, is that the teachers, because they often are working from home, they become invisible, and so it's only, again, when they step outside themselves and are reflect upon it, are forced to do any portfolio, or get bad student ratings, or some sort of a trigger happens that that motivates them to change. So I think that this idea, especially I like the idea of listening to various learning resources that are in the environment, and asking people to reflect upon or to answer, you know, which of these are used, and which kind of examples really do change your practice, and then seeing if they do lead to changes in practice beyond the perceptions is really useful work. I appreciate it's kind of, it's probably slow and time consuming, but equally or perhaps more important in distance environment than in a face-to-face. So thanks for sharing that.
Terry, one comment on that I didn't have time to explain is that when we elicited learning experience reports from the teacher, we asked them questions such as, what was the situation? What did you learn? What did you do that you learned this? And what did you think in the situation? How did you feel? And what did you want? And I think that method of collecting learning experience reports and later on from distant learners, like distant learning teachers, is very useful to explore how distance education teachers teach. And I do not have the actual job aid that we gave to teachers. We gave them a number of clouds almost that with little blurbs in it, like what did you learn, where were you, what did you feel, what was going on, to help the teacher elaborate on their learning experience. So I can share that with you if you want.
Anna Marie, when you're, you know, I can't help thinking when you're asking these teachers in a face-to-face situation what they've learned and not so much what they've learned, but what they're feeling, so much of that and what they're feeling is going to be dependent on the feedback that they're getting from the students, and a lot of that feedback is the benefit you get from face-to-face. They'll see the expressions, they'll see the actions very immediately, whereas you don't necessarily, quite often you don't get that in distance education. So I'm wondering how those questions would have to be reframed for distance education.
Yeah, that's a good point. For instance, I do think that in face-to-face education, teachers have a tendency to assume what their students are thinking by just looking at them. So that is one of the pitfalls, I think, of face-to-face teaching, is that teachers, or one of the challenges for teachers, is that teachers do not always realize that their own interpretation of the situation may not be the interpretation of the student. And maybe in a distance education environment, this is different, because when teacher and student are trying to make sense of student questions, for instance, it's all much more recorded, and both have much more time to reflect on it. So if you would ask distance education teachers, how did you learn, you can ask them what communication with the student made you think this? Did you, so that would be, for instance, one question that in distance education would certainly work, I think.
Right, thank you. We're back to that whole problem with making assumptions in face-to-face situations. Thanks for that. You're right.
Any other questions or comments?
Well, actually, we're coming near the end of the hour, and I don't mean to hog the mic. I did have one other comment that just kept coming to my mind as you were going through this. I really found the times when I've given most consideration to how I've learned informally and what I've learned informally was when I was then trying to teach those things to other teachers. For instance, I remember very clearly the first time in a face-to-face classroom when I had a student teacher come in, and all of that informal learning that I had experienced all of a sudden was apparent to me when I saw a student teacher come in who didn't have those advantages and didn't have those same experiences, and I realized how, hey, I do know a few things here, and it gave me I guess the motivation to think about what I had learned and how I had learned it informally. And I'm wondering if those kind of situations could be used in a similar study to this, or and in distance education, where it's when you're trying to tell somebody else or show somebody else that you have those opportunities to see what's happened.
Yeah, thank you very much, Lynn. That is, of course, something that we found too, and what Marcel and I actually talked about earlier on, is to make your experiences explicit is a valuable way of learning already. So in our study, we try to avoid that, but of course the implications are that, well, two basic major implications. Teachers generally do not consider themselves as learners, and that in our era of lifelong learning, I think it is important to encourage teachers to actually consider themselves as learners. But also the managers, the employers need to acknowledge that everybody is learning and give them chance to learn.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Annemarieke, for sharing this research with us. And I know you're going to leave us all thinking about ways where this could be applied to distance education situations. And for those of you who would like to look back on her materials and her article and the PowerPoint and so forth, all of that is available on the CIDR website. And as I mentioned earlier, the recordings will be there also. So pass those along by all means. And thank you for joining us for this presentation. And before we lose too many more participants, I do want to point out that our next presentation will be taking place on Wednesday, December 3rd at 11 a.m. Mountain Time. That's Edmonton, Alberta time. And the title of that presentation is Designing Online Synchronous Communication to Strengthen Students' Second Language Communication Skills. That is going to be a group participation from Elizabeth Murphy from Memorial University, and Camilla Studley, Paula Thomas, and Kate Skirth. So hopefully some of you can join us for that on December 3rd. Thanks again, Annemarieke, for sharing your time with us. And thank you to everybody who was able to make it for the session today.
Yes, Kate, go ahead.